Spectrum Business keeps real businesses, like Rise Bakery, connected.
As a business owner, my Spectrum services help simplify my day. Everything we do is easier knowing that we've got a reliable connection. And it helps our business just run really smoothly. Even though our techniques are very ancient, we rely just as heavily on technology. Spectrum allows my business to go from surviving to thriving.
Keep your business running smoothly with Spectrum Internet, starting at $40 a month. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
To talk all things Cleveland Guardians, he is Guardians TV analyst Chris Jimenez. He joins us now on the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate you having me on.
It's always great to have you. We saw the Hosey thing a little differently last night. I am a little more old school. I either wanted somebody plunked or I wanted vote tossed from that game in that moment. I think my partner more was looking towards as an opportunity for Steven Vogt to get tossed. As a former player, when you see that happen and how things played out yesterday, was that a missed opportunity to make a statement if you're Steven Vogt and the Guardians?
I don't think it was. I actually think he did a pretty good job of making the statement, ultimately, without even getting himself thrown out of the game. I think a lot of us, truthfully, would have loved to have seen him get super animated, get kicked out of the game. And, you know, I think it goes a long way in the clubhouse for sure. But the fact that he went out there and he kind of got, you know, in the face of the opposing manager, I'm in for that. Truthfully, to me, that shows that not only does he have our backs as players, but I think he was also being extremely smart in how he was doing it, you know, trying to fire the guys up. You know, obviously, the game did not go well, even though, especially early on, we put some really good swings on Kevin Gausman. It just nothing really to show for it. It turns out when Miles Straw is in center field, things don't really drop like they do with other center fielders. And unfortunately, we found that out the hard way.
Can you explain what's happening right now? I'm going to give you a couple instances throughout the past three games that kind of just, I don't know, stood out to me. The first one being Jonathan Rodriguez on the Ernie Clement play, just kind of jogging down the line and really not giving any effort there. And then it happened again with the Andrés Giménez play that he was involved in as well. And then the other one is, even though it was a Manzardo error, I get that and understand that, the play yesterday where he throws to the plate and Bo Naylor's picking dandelions, it's not even looking at the ball as it's coming towards him. Like, what is going on here with some of the mental lapses and even just the lack of effort that seems to be given off here?
Right. I think, first of all, with the mental lapses, I think it's everybody on this team trying to be the guy. You know, we saw that on the last road trip, especially how it started off early in Seattle. You could tell there was some tenseness at the plate. Steven Vogt's come out multiple times and said, we need to get back to playing the type of baseball that we play, style of ball that we play, meaning we have scrappy at-bats. Not one guy is going to win it or lose it for us. And I think you're trying to see somebody step up and make a play. Now, in times like this, obviously that particular scenario did not go great, because you love the fact that he's at least willing to make, you know, somewhat of a play like that. But I think the best case scenario right there would be turn around, get the out. I see guys thinking too much. You know what I mean? That's probably the best way to describe it, is everybody out there is thinking far too much. They're not letting their baseball instincts come into play. And when this team's really good, instinctually, they're very good as well. They don't necessarily have to think about a play beforehand. It just happens. They've maybe pre-thought it, and then it's there. Now you use your eyes to go out there and make the judgment call on the field. In regards to the lack of hustle, you know, that's a little more concerning, especially from a young guy. You know, when you've got the best player on your team that never takes a playoff and Jose Ramirez, I think that there's probably going to be some words had to Jonathan Rodriguez that, listen, we understand, you know, maybe it's not going the way you want it to offensively, but that's not going to cut it at this level. And trust me, like I said, Jose hustling around does so much, not only for himself in the numbers that he puts up, but what it does and shows the younger players on this team.
So to the first part of what you just said there, and because I think we've talked a lot about it, you can see guys pressing. You can see, and whether it's at bat or in the field. And while I don't agree with Steven Vogt's comments that we're a great lineup, I do think they're much better than the worst lineup in baseball.
For sure.
So, who gets this righted? How do you write this? Whose job is it? How do you get this thing from where it feels like? I mean, I think you've won two of your last seven or eight series.
Right. I mean, again, very fair question. I think ultimately it resides on the players, but I think it resides on the players in the sense that there needs to be a little bit of an adjustment in the approach that you see at the plate. Again, I know how hard it is, and it's natural human instinct to want to be the guy. It's like, don't worry, guys, hop on my back, follow me, I got this, we'll get this thing rolling. That's when you start pressing a little extra. When you just allow the game to come to you and take what the game gives you. So you can't hit a 5-run home run, you know, if you're down by 5 runs. And I know that's pretty cliche, but I think for this particular team, it actually fits very, very well, because I felt like I've seen, especially the last road trip, up there trying to make something happen as opposed to letting the game come to them. And what I mean by an approach change is getting back to what this team should be really good at. It's having really grindy at-bats, you know, not giving yourself up, not trying to hit the long ball. I don't necessarily think this team is particularly equipped to hit long balls with the best in the league. Yes, can they do it? Of course. Of course they can. But that doesn't necessarily mean you need to pick and choose your spots to do it. You need to go out there, have quality at-bats, try to keep the line moving for the next guy. When this team does well offensively, that's the type of approach they have. Very grindy at-bats, constantly trying to get the ball moving for the next guy. Let the next guy be the hero. That's the approach that I think they need to get back to.
Should Chase DeLauter be up in the big leagues?
You know what? That's a fantastic question, and obviously one that everybody is asking. Truthfully, this is probably not going to be a popular answer. He needs to prove that he can stay healthy. And I mean that with the utmost respect to the young man, because if he was healthy this entire season, he most likely would be here right now. And my guess is he will be there at some point. But there's really no rush, truthfully, for his sake. Yes, maybe offensively he would provide a spark that we saw, you know, last year when Kyle Manzardo came up and, you know, some other players like John Kenzie Noel. This team could use that at the big league level, but you also have to think what's best for the player. You can't expect a young man to come up and play 2 or 3 days and then not play again for the rest of the week. Like, they need to show, or he needs to show the organization, that he can stay on the field. And again, no fault of his own. It's just sometimes these things happen. He needs to show the organization that he can be healthy and stay on the field and be productive, because it doesn't do them any good if he comes up to the big leagues and he gets hurt the third game in. Now we're sitting in a situation where not only is he collecting service time, which, again, I could care less about, I just think he's losing that development time in the minor leagues and the big leagues if he's hurt.
Chris, when it comes to – I might have asked you something similar to this a couple weeks ago, but I, you know, just to get back to the idea of the young lineup pressing – I've always believed, at least with bullpen guys, you know, it's easier to have, like, you're my seventh inning guy, you're my eighth inning guy, you're my high leverage guy, you're my closer, because relievers are such creatures of habit. I also think it wouldn't be the worst thing if we just locked into a lineup where it's like, Angel knows he's going to be the 9-hitter, Bo knows right. He's going to be the 8-hitter. Do you see value in that, or is a hitter is that what makes maybe hitting different than a bullpen guy?
Well, definitely that's what makes hitting different than a bullpen guy, because no matter where you hit in the lineup, the approach should be the same. You know, I know sometimes hitting down in the lineup can actually be a benefit to a lot of these young guys, because they're not getting pitched necessarily as hard as they would if they were either hitting in front of Jose or behind Jose, more than likely. I do feel like, though, from a reliever standpoint, they understand that, number one, this is how it is, right? That they're on and okay with the program of this. And we were so lucky last year that these guys came out. Most of them were extremely fresh to being bullpen arms. I mean, you look at Hunter Gaddis in particular, you know, Cade Smith had been in the bullpen. Tim Herron had been in the bullpen, but Tim Herron was a starter 2 years before that. So was Hunter Gaddis. Now, at the big league level, being in the bullpen and in the minor league level is pretty significant difference. They took to it quite well. They understand they're high leverage guys. Just because it's the seventh inning, that might not necessarily mean it's the highest leverage of the game. The highest leverage of the game could very well be in the fifth inning. And I think we're starting to see a swing of that. You know, Terry Francona was so good at that with Andrew Miller back in the day, in particular, in our playoff run in 16, he used him in the highest leverage situations, and you can figure it out from there. What we have to our benefit this year and last was we have multiple guys that you feel comfortable with throwing in those high leverage situations. You know, Class A's got the ninth. From there, you can work backwards to, if it is a high leverage situation in that sixth inning, guess who's coming out of the pen? It's Cade Smith. And if that situation happens to be in the eighth inning, it's Cade Smith coming out. After that, it's Hunter Gaddis. It's Tim Herron, especially if there's a left-hander, you know, in this lineup and you're taking the platoon advantage. So it is a significant difference, but I think the bullpen in particular, these guys are so used to it and they understand that leverage doesn't necessarily mean 7, 8, and 9. It could be 4, 5, and 6, truthfully.
Do you feel like the Guardians platoon too much?
I don't think too much. I just think they're still trying to find, there's so many young players on this offense that it's extremely difficult, right? Because hitting in the big leagues is hard enough as it is. You've got Jose Ramirez, who's literally the best in baseball at it, and he does it from both sides of the plate. But again, he's only one man, and I feel like you're going to go through some of these growing pains at times. And again, we saw it last year at times, but I think overall this offense was built differently than it is this year. They need to be a little more reliant on those quality type of bats. Not that they didn't last year, but when you've got a guy like Josh Naylor and David Fry for an entire season that can drive the ball out of the ballpark, if you make a mistake, it changes the way opposing pitchers attack our hitters. We don't have that necessarily big bopper in the lineup, in the heart of the lineup, besides Hosey. So they change the way they pitch to our offense, and I think our offense is just having a little bit of a slower time adjusting to that pace.
How close are we to the rotation breaking through and being consistently a top 10 rotation?
So that is an awesome question. Honestly, I really like where our rotation's at. Slade Ciccone has been fantastic since he's come back, start the season. It was a little bit of a rough start for him in particular, but I think he's really starting to understand the type of pitcher he can be and the type of pitcher he used to be. You know, that's a significant difference. Give Carl Willis about as much credit as you could possibly give, because they saw something in this young man that I don't know if many other organizations saw, including the one that drafted him in the Arizona Diamondbacks. And that's not a knock on the Diamondbacks. They tried to do their best with him, but Carl has gotten the best out of Ciccone. I think Gavin Williams, truthfully, I know this has been an extremely up and down season for him. He's got arguably the best stuff on the staff. I mean, you got a rotation headed by Tanner Bibee, who's an absolute dog. Even though yesterday the line ultimately looks terrible because we didn't score a run, he ended up giving up three runs, but he's going to give you a chance to win a baseball game. Is he a guy that's going to go out and punch out 14 or 15 every night? No, he's not. And I think he understands that as well. But he's going to give you an opportunity to win a baseball game, keeping your offense close enough to where you can be within striking distance. And then you add in Luis Ortiz. Truthfully, I'm really excited about him and Ciccone in particular. What's not to be excited about? Gavin Williams and Tanner Bibee. But now you add two more young starters. Luis Ortiz has arguably some of the most movement in baseball, and he throws the ball 98 freaking miles an hour. The hardest thing for him is learning how to truly control it, because any given day, the ball could move up to 26 inches, and it could be at 18 inches one day. So having to learn how to figure out to control that can be difficult, but I think he's done a really good job. He's really settled down. He's had a couple of rough starts, which, again, all young starters will have, but I could not be more excited about this rotation, truthfully. I think that is the hallmark of our organization. And then you add in this bullpen, which has a chance to be pretty good. I think the problem we get into is understanding these guys know they have to go out there and throw up a bunch of zeros. And if they give up a run or two early in particular, it's really, really tough, because the offense has had a hard time, you know, being able to combat that as well.
Chris, I saw some side-by-side comparisons of the career that Jose's had versus Nolan Arenado, who we'll see tonight. And then the WAR is basically identical. A lot of the numbers outside, I mean, Jose obviously steals bases in a way sure. that Arenado just doesn't, but a lot of the numbers are just so incredibly similar. And part of me got excited by that, because I think Nolan Arenado is a great player. But the other part of me was like, oh, Arenado at the end of the day is going to be considered a very underrated player. And he'll probably just barely, he'll be in the Hall of Very Good, not the Hall of Fame.
Sure.
Well, the difference between J-Ram and Arenado when it's all said and done, is it just these upcoming couple years where Arenado seems like he's fallen off, and then if J-Ram can continue to play at the high rate that he's played?
I think J-Ram's a Hall of Famer already, truthfully. I think what he's done from a third base standpoint in particular, nobody's stolen more bases in baseball than Jose Ramirez. From the third base position, he's continuing to walk up the, you know, the organizational leaderboards. And I think too, Arenado gets a little knock for that, truthfully. Yes, he gets a knock for playing in Colorado, which I don't know is necessarily fair, but I think switching organizations like that gives you also a little knock in regards to how the voters used to vote. Now, that regime is really renewing itself, so to speak. There's a lot of that old guard that is getting out of the voting for the Hall of Fame, and a lot of newer age, you know, writers, guys that have understanding, or gals too. I mean, just people that have understanding of common metrics that are utilized in today's day and age. I think those people truly understand the value of what Jose brings, because he affects the game so many different ways. You know, Arenado's WAR is also so high because defensively he's better than Jose Ramirez. Not that Jose Ramirez is bad, but when you have 7 or 8 consecutive gold gloves with a platinum glove mixed in there, it's easy to see, right? Jose doesn't have that to his resume, but he's done offensively what Nolan Arenado could not in regards to the longevity of it. As soon as he got out of Colorado, those numbers came back down to earth a little bit, and he's had a hard time kind of keeping that up, where Jose's been extremely consistent the entire time. So I think ultimately Jose has a better career. Again, not a knock on Arenado by any means, because he's a hell of a third baseman and a good offensive player as well. But I think ultimately we're looking at a walking monument who will have his statue out in center field there at some point after he retires.
Chris, Slade Ciccone was on our midday show yesterday, and they thought his middle name, because of the internet, they thought his middle name was Gustav, and apparently it's Devin. Have fans ever come up to you thinking they know something about you and they get it dreadfully wrong?
Well, yeah. You can tell my last name is, you know, it's not necessarily American, I guess you could say, but it's not Spanish either. It's Spanish, and everybody thinks that I just, you know, because I have an EZ in my last name, that I just speak fluent Spanish, or they're telling me that I'm pronouncing my own last name wrong, and I've had that quite a few times, actually.
Andres didn't help you around these parts here, Chris.
Yeah,
you were before him, but he didn't help you. Yeah.
That's all right. It happens. I'm used to it at this point.
Chris, great stuff, man. Appreciate you. We'll talk to you down the line. Hopefully get a couple Guardians victories here.
Let's go get a couple victories, and let's reconvene and have another conversation we can have a little more positivity with. I like it.
We're ready for it, buddy. Thank you so much. Chris Jimenez there, former Cleveland Indian, now Guardians TV analyst on the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline, where the Browns might be underrated in 5 minutes on 92.3 The Fan. Not a lot of things about the Browns right now are being described as underrated, right? Maybe the D-line. Yeah.
Even that, I mean, okay, that's a good one, because PFF had them at 7th overall.
Yeah.
And I was like, what, 7th? It's supposed to be the best part of this team. Are they not accounting for Mason Graham? What's going on here?
But two guys who used to work at PFF, now part of the 33rd team and the Check the Mic podcast, Sam Monson and Steve Palazzolo, talked about one part of the Browns that might be criminally underrated.
I think this is a crazy grading. I think this is utterly ridiculous, in fact. Again, starting point. Myles Garrett demanded a trade. Instead of trading one of the best players in the NFL, they've extended him and got him locked into a new contract. You can debate how they got there, but they ended up with the quarterback I would have taken at number two. Like, I would have taken Shedeur Sanders just because I think they need a way out of that. They got him in the 5th round. So they got the same guy, and they're paying him like a fraction of the money they would be paying him if they got him at number two. And they got an extra roll of the dice, like a bonus lottery ticket with Dylan Gabriel in the 3rd round as well. And trade down and pick up the extra first round pick next year. And as much as Travis Hunter is special, he's unique, somebody that hasn't come along for decades, I still think the smart move is to pick up the first round pick for next year, if for no other reason than you need the quarterback, not the guy that plays corner or wide receiver.
So what I do think is a very interesting context to this is there were points at the very beginning of the offseason where we thought this was going to be a disastrous offseason for the Browns. It didn't turn out to be that. So at least in that way alone, it's underrated.
First off, very brave of Sam to admit that he wanted the Browns to take him at number two overall, and then watching him go to the 5th round, because there are not many people out there that are willing to put that take back out there.
Well, see, because they said the opposite 2 weeks previously, so they flip-flopped enough that they can say they said anything.
Is that what it is?
Okay. Yeah, you are one of the few, you and Sam together.
Just very brave of him, because it's just not, I didn't know it was a real brothers-in-arms handshake emoji agreement moment between Sam and myself. I just feel like so many people have run from any idea that they ever even wanted Shedeur Sanders at number two. So even like bring that back out there, tip of the cap to you. Jeter, respect, tip of the cap to you right there.
That's actually, that's a great point. How many people have, since the draft, just been like, yeah, no, we knew he was going to be a 5th round pick. It's like, he didn't know bleep. However, do you think that the Browns offseason is underrated?
So they haven't, outside of the draft, I would love to know why they think it's underrated. Like, the draft was great, and there's a lot of pieces of it that could potentially be great, is what I should say. I liked a lot of this draft. I really did. Even from the running back side of things, there's a lot to enjoy. But it's not like they spent a lot of money in a lot of places. It's not as if we added a lot of, you know, we didn't add anything as far as the offensive line is concerned outside of Tevin Jenkins. We didn't do anything with the wide receivers.
He did add Malik Collins. He's your big ticket this offseason, which is not typically a big ticket, but that's your biggest move so far.
Yeah, and we pointed that out the other day when we were reading the whole recap of the Browns in general a couple days ago that ESPN had out there, where it was, what, $17 million in total? And that was the big ticket move. That was the biggest actual money-making change that you did. It's just not a lot. It's not a lot that was put towards this team.
So I think because if the Browns had intended to win, Deshaun has a good year last year, but somehow you end up with a top five pick, whatever. If the Browns intended to win this next year, then they were going to be really hard-pressed to make those kind of moves, but they could have done it. They could have kicked more money down the road. They could have kicked more stuff down, kicked the can down the road on a few more contracts, maybe had a few more extensions kind of lined up. But because I think they looked at this and said, what if we just have a year where we just kind of see where it goes? Which is very different than the three previous offseasons. Maybe
real businesses like Malibu Apothecary rely on Spectrum to keep them connected.
We're a fragrance company, but we also have a lot of technology that we use. Spectrum is really the backbone of any of the business we do here. Having a reliable, fast internet service that can fit my budget is really great. I traded a 9-to-5 for a 5-to-9. It's a lot of work, but I love it.
Spectrum Business Internet starts at $40 a month when bundled. Learn more at spectrum.com/business. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
Five or six previous off seasons, there weren't a lot of things they could do. So something like Miles and navigating the trade request, yes, absolutely. That's a feather in your cap if you think the best thing for them to do was to re-sign Miles and keep him in the groove there. Because they don't have a lot of big ticket trades or free agent, practically none, which again, they shouldn't have. They should not have moved more cap around.
I don't disagree with it, by the way. They should have. I would have done exactly what they did in many, many respects to this offseason.
So in a way, it's a safe offseason. And again, there are no safe offseasons because you can screw up the safe moves. You can screw up the draft. But yeah, I didn't listen at the start of this. I didn't want the Browns throwing good money after bad, which is continuing to chase this idea of we're a playoff team, we're a championship team. I looked at this as the last Russ Wilson year in Denver, where it was, you're going to play here, we're going to try and figure this out, but we're not beholden to you, and we're just going to try and get through a couple bad contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, that is what they're setting this up to. So I think I they didn't swim against the current, which is smart because they shouldn't have.
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to figure out what part of it then is considered an underrated off season.
It's the Miles thing for him.
Is that what it is?
Yes.
Just be retaining the guy that PFF has as the best defensive player in the sport the past three seasons, according to their grading. That was enough to make the offseason to win.
So yes, and
okay.
How do you feel about that?
No, if you want to call it a win, I don't know that I make it then underrated and sneaky good. But yeah, losing Miles would have been a completely different scenario for a lot of people.
I think the only thing that they could have done that was earth-shaking one way or another this offseason was trade Miles. And I think it would have taken a lot more stones to trade Miles than call him on his bleep. But you did do. I mean, listen, I don't know you could even have said that there would have been the only thing that would have been bad for Miles is if you had made a bad trade for Miles, but like you called him on his bleep. You knew Miles well enough that with just subtle pressure of free agency coming up, he'd fold like a cheap accordion. And that's exactly what he did. I think, like, listen, I got a lot of things to say about the Browns. I would have traded Miles. I was a little over Miles. I was a little over. And I saw what Miles was saying, by the way. I saw his point of view, which is I want to win. I sympathize with that. I think he had earned that at this point. And I also thought you can get an earth-shaking kind of trade for Miles. It could end up being the best of both worlds. That said, you knew him better than anyone, and you called him on his you-know-what. Granted, you gave him $40 million a year, but yeah, that's what he's worth.
It's what he's worth.
So, yeah. I'm loath to give Andrew Berry credit because we can look at his free agent moves. Not a lot have worked out really well. His trades have been, by and large, pretty darn good, but his drafting has not been nearly good enough. Not a disastrous GM, but not a great GM. Somewhere in the middle and probably towards the bottom. I think we got to give him more credit for this offseason.
So what's tough about that, though, is in response to the Myles Garrett side of things, it does kind of feel like you're crediting the arsonist for putting out the fire. You know, like if he had done his job better, Myles Garrett wouldn't have been going on Radio Row trying to demand trades and trying to request everything and find his way out of it. So in a weird way, yes, he did a great job in calling out his bluff and getting to a spot where he could just pay Myles Garrett a bunch of money. But it does feel like you're crediting the arsonist for putting out the fire.
Well, the thing is, I don't really think it was ever about that for Miles. Because I think it was proven that when he signed for the money he signed and he just gave in. And we can talk about how he didn't have leverage. He did have leverage. Trey Hendrickson is still holding out. Oh, gosh, Shamar Stewart is still holding out. He's a draft pick. So, like, Miles didn't even test it. It was very apparent that once Miles saw $40 million a year, Miles thought, well, you know what, losing in Cleveland isn't so bad. So, like, I don't even know that I originally agree that Andrew's the arsonist. I think it is like a Scooby-Doo situation where you rip off the Andrew mask and the real arsonist to the whole saga that is Miles' trade demand is Miles himself.
No, I'm looking more at the idea that he's the constructor of the team and the team itself is why Miles wanted out. That's why he'd be the arsonist in this scenario.
I think that's just been proven. I think that's been negated by the fact that Miles just took the money and shut up.
Yeah, we've disagreed on that before. It's okay. We don't have to rehash the Myles Garrett thing right now. But the point is, at least for me, is it overrated? Is it underrated? How do you view the Browns offseason if keeping Miles is the only thing you do? And because he's that impactful of a player, if you want to tell me that's made it a sneaky underrated offseason, I'm all right with that.
216-474-0092. For you guys, do you think the Browns are having an underrated offseason? I know people are loath to give the Browns any sort of credit for anything right now. Coming off 3-14 of the Deshaun debacle, I actually think we probably should in terms of the general direction of this offseason. More on why it's underrated in 5 minutes on 92.3 The Fan. There's just so few things to actually grade them off of. Like, the Browns really are in a weird situation where I don't know that we can grade them off wins and losses this year because I think they're going to be few and far between. And you kind of can say the same thing. Like, is it an underrated offseason that you just didn't screw it up?
I guess so. How much can I put your offseason on what your draft is? But it feels like that was, minus the Miles part, the whole entire everything.
Like, okay. So
if I liked your draft, shouldn't I have liked your offseason?
So the three big things are what? Myles Garrett, the draft, and your quarterback room. And yeah. I don't think you could have made a better quarterback room without putting too much money into a team that I don't know the difference between Kirk Cousins and Joe Flacco's worth that much or
Daniel Jones and Kenny Pickett necessarily.
I actually might like Daniel Jones more.
No,
than
I knew
like
you
Kenny
would.
Pickett.
That's why I wanted to bring him into the mix here with just a little bit.
But now that I have Kenny Pickett,
he's probably going to start in Indy, by the way.
And they're going to inexplicably win 10 games. He's going to get another $140 million. And then they're going to be right where the Giants are. Shane Steichen, we put on a float. And you can see this coming from a mile away.
One day we can do a study about how Anthony Richardson played 13 college games and was just a combine All-American and then got taken fourth overall.
We call that the Mike Mamula. Anybody, you remember him?
Mike Mamula.
Yeah, he was like a mid-90s first pick overall. That the whole point was he was okay in college, but man, can you see him work out? There was just like underlaid things there of like, I think these guys just thought he was cute.
I mean, seriously, that's what it is with Anthony Richardson. Like, he broke combine records and was just like a vertical. He was an athletic freak is what he was. But he played 13 college games, and that was enough. Think about how exhaustive that process was for Shedeur Sanders and the hoops he had to jump through and everything he had to go through and the diagnosis and the analysis and everything. And Anthony Richardson, 13 college games. Completed like 50% in college too, like just yep. Wildly inaccurate. Hence why he completed 47% in the NFL so far in his career, and got taken fourth overall.
I walked to the store today before the show, as seen by the fact I've been grazing for the last 2 hours.
Is that what happens to you, by the way? Because I've noticed when you do walks before the shows, you do end up grazing.
Not normally. Yes, I do graze. I'm just fat. But normally
I've been grazing lately.
Walk down to like Cleveland Clothing Store and back to get some extra steps in.
It's a good walk.
But today, your boy was just feeling a little peckish, because that's what happens when you're heavy and you haven't had anything. So I felt a little peckish, but there was a guy, and he was just jacked as all get out. Like, he looked like a middle linebacker in the NFL. And the shorts were short. I could tell everything about this fella.
Mm-hmm.
He looked incredibly impressive until you watch him walk.
Even there, too, huh?
Yeah, definitely there. Good job, sir. Good for you.
Well, he didn't enjoy do anything. Bulge. He didn't do anything to get it. But then
you watched him walk, and it's like, this is the least athletic, most jacked person I've ever seen. Like, maybe it's the weight of things holding him down, but like, he just...
That's too bad.
Yes, it's a character from San Andreas from Grand Theft Auto.
It is one of the funniest. One of the funniest things in life is when you played on softball teams, I'm sure, some of those men's leagues and such, and you have these guys that just look jacked, and then when they try to swing a bat, just looks just so awful.
Or
really athletic people, athletic-looking people, not looking athletic is very funny to me.
So even funnier, I played on one men's adult softball league, never again. Never again. No, because I look ridiculous running full speed at this point, I was still in my late 20s. But I was awful because I hadn't swung a bat in a decade. And it was overall very traumatizing. We had this kid who, when he was at bat, he swung like Pujols. It was a beautiful swing. And then when he started running.
Real businesses like Malibu Apothecary rely on Spectrum to keep them connected.
We're a fragrance company, but we also have a lot of technology that we use. Spectrum is really the backbone of any of the business we do here. Having a reliable, fast internet service that can fit my budget is really great. I traded a 9-to-5 for a 5-to-9. It's a lot of work, but I love it.
Spectrum Business Internet starts at $40 a month when bundled. Learn more at spectrum.com/business. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
Thing. It was the least manly athletic run ever. Mm. And I was on his team. He's the only good ball player we had. But I always rooted for him to get, like, not a home run, because he could do the home run trot and look super athletic.
Yeah.
But if, man, he had to hustle out like a double, I would sit there.
He'd run like a duck or what?
I don't even know how to say it. It was like Elaine dancing in Seinfeld, because middle-aged people, the only thing we have is Seinfeld references. But yeah, it was like that, but the version of running, and I would just sit there, and none of my teammates would even notice it, because they were just impressed that he just hit the ball 300 feet and got a triple, and I would just sit there with my face covered and just giggle the entirety of the time, and we'd get blown out by like 20 runs.
If I was that man's therapist, we would start with the deep-rooted issues of he became a great baseball player and had a Pujols-esque swing to overcompensate for the fact that he runs like Elaine dancing.
Also did have a very big truck. Very, very big truck. And he wasn't a farmer. I'm just saying, there was a lot of things. Maybe the antithesis of our friend on the street.
Your awareness of other guys' packages is just, it's on another level.
That's called awareness.
All right? Enjoy the bulge.
Madden 99.
Just not things I ever pay attention to.
Yet.
Yeah.
In fairness, this guy today... He turned the corner, and it turned the corner 2 minutes earlier.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So
he was playing catch.
Yeah. So that's not on me.
Yeah,
all right.
Okay.
I'd have to be looking for Superman to avoid the damn thing. All right.
Thanks. It's a great visual. I'm thinking of just a guy just turning the corner. Oh, I'm right there. So he's got to talk to it to make sure that it knows he didn't leave it.
So
some people have a dog. You know, other people have.
Some got that dog in them. Well, yeah.
All right.
So, those three things.
Yeah, what do you think? Wait, what did your story with the big guy have? Did it have somewhere else we were going out of that? Or
No. They were just two very athletic people
who did
not do things in an athletic manner.
Okay. Because
it's like, what's the point of looking like that if then you look like Mighty Mouse when you run?
Yeah, I mean, Anthony Richardson still looks good when he runs, I would imagine.
He just
couldn't play football.
He does,
Just can't play quarterback. And Daniel Jones is going to have that opportunity because Anthony Richardson can't. I can't get over that. I can't get over the whole idea that he just got taken fourth overall because he just looked awesome in the combine.
But isn't that like the draft, the great flaw of the draft? If you look like a football player, you're going to be overdrafted.
Well, and then remember the quote from Chris Ballard? I won't be able to sleep at night if he becomes awesome elsewhere. It's like, that doesn't mean you have to take him fourth overall.
In fairness, surviving that big of a busted quarterback and not getting fired is one of the five. It's right up there with the Deshaun Watson trade of you made the worst trade in NFL history and didn't get fired. That's some level of a Hall of Fame achievement.
Irsay was incredibly loyal to him. Now that Jim Irsay is passed, though, I don't know if that's going to maintain.
Oh, I actually,
we don't know. We don't know how the new set of Irsay daughters are.
I'm going to imagine they're a little more even keel than dad.
Well, they're definitely more even keel. But Irsay was letting all these guys just kind of hang out for a while. Like, I mean, it just kind of, that was just part of his DNA. He was very loyal in a weird way. He was very loyal to Chris Ballard in particular.
So is there anything we can actually hammer the Browns on for their offseason?
Probably not. If you actually wanted them to win games, you'd tell them to spend more money, right? But it doesn't seem like they're not really in the business of winning 9, 10, 11 games. Like, I'd be mad if they were trying to tell us that they were a 9, 10, 11 win team and they just didn't do anything with their wide receiver position. I'd be pretty pissed.
So here becomes the problem.
But I can't be mad about it.
But here's the problem. Then doesn't Andrew Berry deserve credit?
Credit for what?
For having a good offseason. Because again, we can look at the other body of the work, but we're trying to evaluate him and Kevin in real time.
If the draft, and you shouldn't judge a draft this soon, but we judge it quicker than we ever have these days. If the pieces of the draft looks good, we're going to look back and say, good job, Andrew Berry.
Well, but there's nothing that's going to make the Jacksonville trade look worse, right? Unless you get like the 20th pick and Travis Hunter looks like
a... I'm talking more about the players. I'm talking more about like if Judkins looks good Mason Graham looks good. Like if Mason Graham doesn't look like he knows what he's doing, then yes, that will make the Jacksonville trade look worse.
Shouldn't the trade down be a bigger thing than even how Mason works?
No,
like if Mason sticks, but you get the number one pick, I think you still win the exchange.
We still have to judge on the idea that at number 5 overall, you went with Mason Graham. We have to judge you off of your selective ability of that. And then even within that, the two picks you had, just because you had picks, you still have to hit on those picks.
No, I do agree with the general sentiment you're making. I think we're a really interesting spot where I think you can make the case like Sam Monson did that Andrew Berry had a good offseason, and then you're going to go out there and they might go 3-14 and then you're not going to get credit for it.
Yes, but even if he had a good offseason in so much inactivity, essentially, it has not come anywhere close to erasing the previous 5 years of his job. And so, like, if he's trying to crack away at that, that's where he's got to do it with actually getting the Mason Grahams, the Judkins, the Fannins of the world. That's where he's got to start getting those things right, and then he starts chipping away at what has been 5 years of just not being a very good GM.
216-474-0092. Sam Monson and the Check the Mic podcast, formerly of PFF, saying the Browns are having an underrated offseason. Do you agree with that? And does that mean you have to give Andrew Berry a little bit more credit than we're willing to give him heading into training camp and beyond? And a takeaway from the NBA draft I did not see coming. And of course, it'll impact the Cavaliers. In 5 minutes on 92.3 The Fan.
Real businesses like Malibu Apothecary rely on Spectrum to keep them connected.
We're a fragrance company, but we also have a lot of technology that we use. Spectrum is really the backbone of any of the business we do here. Having a reliable, fast internet service that can fit my budget is really great. I traded a 9-to-5 for a 5-to-9. It's a lot of work, but I love it.
Spectrum Business Internet starts at $40 a month when bundled. Learn more at spectrum.com/business. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.